I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, trying to get up to speed on Latin America on the eve of Evo Morales's visit to Brown University at the end of February. Julia Buxton is at the conference on change in the Andes at Brown University this week from Bradford University in England. Julia Buxton, you make a dramatic case that in all the world, it's the Latin model now, and of Venezuela in particular, that is the key to development.
The important thing about Venezuela, the lessons learned we can draw from that country, is how you can deliver pro-poor programs in countries where institutions have failed. And this is tremendously important in places like Nepal, Sierra Leone, these Western and East African countries, where development aid has consistently failed to reach the poorest sectors of society. So we can look at what's going on in Venezuela and say, how do you deliver pro-poor policies in a situation of institutional failure? And Venezuela, to my mind, brings very, very important lessons learned. And secondly, what's fascinating about Venezuela is they're actually implementing what's really considered best practice in development strategy. The kinds of policies that we've seen introduced there, mainstreaming of gender, expanding microcredit facilities for poor people, this is recognised today as best practice in development. But unfortunately, because it's happening in Venezuela, people are simply not taking it seriously.
How did we get here? And most specifically, from what's now generally kicked around as the neoliberal Washington consensus of free trade development.
Well, what we had in the 1980s and the 1990s was, as you say, this idea of the Washington consensus, the neoliberal model. And the emphasis here was that poverty, where it was factored into this model, poverty could be reduced by a process of economic growth. So there was an assumption in the Washington consensus model of a linear process of change. Once you had economic growth, by default, that would trickle down to the poorest sectors of society and the whole nation would benefit. But there was a real problem with the Washington consensus in that it did generate economic growth, but it did not generate pro-poor economic growth. The poor were left behind. So yes, you have competition, yes, you have globalization and markets, but if you're poor, you couldn't benefit from that. Now, what we saw in the 2000s was the development of this post-Washington consensus. You know, people like Jeffrey Sachs, Joseph Stiglitz, who were recanting their earlier emphasis on this neoliberal Washington consensus model. And these people were recognising that the poor had to be directly addressed, because if you don't address the needs of the poor ultimately become a drag on further economic development. So in the kind of revised post-Washington consensus model, what you have is an emphasis on interventions that help the poor. But the fundamental problem to my mind with the post-Washington consensus is that it still retains the core features of the original Washington consensus model. It still retains the idea that economic growth can lead to reductions in poverty. It still emphasizes free trade. It still emphasizes globalization and the reduction in the role of the state. The problem with that model is that it doesn't recognize the state can intervene directly. It doesn't recognize that you need to have a massive increase in direct pro-poor support. It doesn't weld together economic policy and social policy. And unless you have social policy integral to your economic policy model, then you simply cannot reduce poverty at the level that we need in order to achieve meaningful human security and the Millennium Development Goals.
Jeff Sachs is a friend and a teacher over many years with deep experience in Bolivia most especially, but he too acknowledges what you're saying, that free trade and neoliberal policies widened the gap of incomes in Latin America. And furthermore, that in Bolivia, say, it stands to reason that the European elite has never invested deeply in the welfare of the indigenous majority, from whom they've been alienated over many generations. What needs to be adjusted in all that hindsight?
I think what we're really learning now, sadly after 30 years of failure, well, a longer history of failure, really, this external imposition of development models, is that in countries, the South American countries, which have these profound levels of inequality, there needs to be higher, more coherent and integrated models of intervention in order to address structurally embedded inequalities. It's simply not good enough to have social policy as a kind of add-on, a bolt-on fixture of macroeconomic policies intended to lead to globalization and market integration. There's three things here which I think are absolutely fundamental. The first is that economic democracy is not possible without political democracy and vice versa. There has to be a redistribution of wealth and assets in order to enhance human capacity and then in turn people's capabilities to participate fully in their political systems. Secondly, we need to have country ownership and country context specificity in the models that we devise and seek to impose on these countries. We need to allow these countries to develop their own ideas, to consult with their own people, to have meaningful stakeholder participation, if there is to be a model of development that truly reflects the needs of the poorest sectors. We can't simply have a pre-packaged idea of what you can impose on these countries. And I think, thirdly, it has to be recognised that global integration, at the pace that's been recommended by your traditional international financial institutions and development agencies, globalisation can bring enormous benefits. But the problem with the globalisation model that we have is that it's not a level playing field. And as long as we maintain the subsidies, the tariffs, the lack of market access for developing countries to the developed world, then the model we're trying to impose is fundamentally hypocritical and contradictory.
You make a tight connection between economic development and democracy, political development. Does it have to be that way, even against the East Asian model in China, say?
Well, I think that's the great value of the Venezuelan model, is that it's actually trying to marry economic development with political democracy and democratic development. But the value of what we can take from what happened in East Asia, from the example of China, a country that's had massive reductions in its poverty level over a 30-year period, is that you can actually have tremendous economic growth if it's owned by the country and is based on economic policy mechanisms that reflect the development needs of that country. So what did China do? It had a model of gradual globalization. It started off with its special economic zones where it allowed investors into, and it had a model of regional trade, which was based on backward linkages to regional economies, the so-called flying geese model of technical innovation, adaptation, and then backward linkage. China opened itself up to investment, but if you look at Chinese investment, the vast bulk of Chinese investment into China is from Korea and Japan. So they had a very tightly controlled process there. So the value of China, yes, there is this claim that, well, it's been an authoritarian-led model, kind of very much like the model in Chile, that you can advance economic development and advance economic growth if you have this highly authoritarian system. But that's not what people want in Venezuela. People want democracy and economic development. So what people like Hugo Chavez are doing are looking at how they can achieve that economic development in the way China did, autonomously, independently, without having to follow the recommendation of the IFIs, but also to wed that to political development. So I think that really what you're seeing in Venezuela is a model of democratization and economic development, which goes against the thrust of the argument that you need a highly authoritarian system before you can advance your economic development model.
Before people like me figured this out, it seemed that the Latin countries themselves, and maybe the Evo Morales government in particular, was telling us that it had to be different.
Well, it had to be different because the model wasn't working. It had to be different because the model, the development model that was being imposed on these countries, that's not to say that they weren't recipients of this. They didn't engage fully. At the time in the 1980s and 90s, you had government by an elite, which was fundamentally disconnected from the majority interests of their countries, that went along with this neoliberal and free market-led model. But what we saw in the 2000s is this constituency of opposition who were deeply connected to those who were worst affected by the impacts of this neoliberalism. And the model had to be different because development was not happening. If anything, these countries were reversing. They were going backwards. So what we're seeing now is these countries actually saying it's for us to develop our own indigenous and endogenous models of development. We know what's in our best interest. We know what our people need. We don't want to have a situation anymore where we have external ideas about the pace, the speed, the nature of our integration into a global economy. We want to develop comparative advantages. If we have natural resources, we want to gain the full benefits of them. We don't want to diversify from them. We don't want to privatize them. We want to rewrite social contracts. So what we're seeing here is the voice of a new majority who are trying to reconnect development to the needs of their people. And that's why I think we're having to listen, because what we're seeing in countries like Bolivia and Venezuela is that where they are allowed to respond to their own domestic constituencies, to develop their own ideas, then these models actually are promoting poverty reduction and economic development. So we need to listen and we need to take lessons learned from these countries.
And what does the Venezuela model require in the free movement of capital, and then free trade.
Well, Venezuela still has this high level of reliance on foreign investment in the country, as it always has done, as most developing countries do. But I think what was interesting with the old Washington consensus was this idea that foreign direct investment was an engine of growth. What we actually saw in the 1990s and 2000s, that most foreign direct investment went from developed country to developed country. It was mainly concentrated in acquisitions and mergers, and the main recipients was the EU and the United States. What Venezuela's trying to do in terms of its foreign investment needs is to acknowledge them, but to look to partners who want to be in there for the longer term. They want partners who are engaged in capital, major infrastructural problems, rather than investors who are just in, for example, to, you know, try and speculate on the currency, to engage in the stock market. What they're looking for is long-term, reliable partners. And at the same time, Venezuela is taking advantage of massive global political economic shifts, specifically the rise of China, resource nationalism in countries like Russia. Venezuela is looking at what was traditionally a very, very close relationship with the US and has clearly come to the conclusion that maintaining that relationship is not in the economic interests of Venezuela. You look at the US economy, massive recession building up, $1 trillion deficit. This is an economic dead weight around the neck of countries like Venezuela. It's fundamentally rational for them to look to countries like China to try and build those investment linkages and to create in Venezuela an investment climate where you have responsible investment with investors there for the long term. So they don't underestimate the value of investment. They just want that investment there under terms conducive to their own national development.
The world is changing. Should we be nervous that the three countries we talk about in particular, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Venezuela, all have strongman populist regimes that make you wonder, where's the broader political development? Where's the wider buy-in of their societies?
Well, I would dispute that. I think the idea that we should look at these countries through the lens of populism is deeply, deeply problematic because it tends to overstate the level of power and influence that these executives have. For example, in the case of Hugo Chavez, we saw that Chavez is actually very, very tightly constrained. Specifically, we saw in the referendum in December that his proposal for constitutional reform was rejected. We're seeing a level of grassroots activism where people are demanding autonomy and empowerment. Chavez can't simply impose things top down. This is a dual process. Things feed from the bottom up. And while we have this emphasis on populism, it kind of obscures from view the complexities of the mechanisms of accountability and representation which are evolving in Venezuela today. So I do think we have had tremendous popular advances in Venezuela, in Bolivia, perhaps less so in Ecuador, where we've had less time to see how President Correa's model is going to roll out. But these governments have certainly brought into power people who have been excluded and marginalised for decades, if not centuries, in the case of Bolivia. The challenge ahead for Bolivia and Venezuela is how you maintain that democratic traction and institutionalise and consolidate the changes that have been introduced. That will be the real test of these radical democracy models.
Could I ask you to make a connection that's not often made? Everybody knows in Venezuela about the Sistema, this almost universal training of children in string instruments. They now have one of the most famous orchestras and brilliant young conductors in the world. But people don't mention these things together, political and economic reform and universal music for everybody's kid. Should we associate them?
Oh, absolutely. It's quite interesting, actually, because with the Venezuelan Youth Orchestra and the lessons of the Sistema, we're seeing them being absorbed around the world. We've had a delegation very recently from Venezuela visiting Scotland in the United Kingdom, and the Scottish Parliament are adopting the Sistema as well. And the intense value, I mean, we saw this in South Africa as well, where there was a similar program. The intense value of these programs is that they create a sense of community and responsibility, which fundamentally goes against the kind of individualistic notions, the social Darwinist idea of, you know, survival of the fittest. It builds a sense of responsibility and community which has been so missing in the fabric of these societies, which has been fundamentally unravelled and shattered. So it's a way of bringing people together. It's a way of restoring pride and also of valuing children and the input that children can have into your society. So I do think that the Sistema model is important because it's an emphasis on allowing people who wouldn't have access to something like music, orchestra, classical music. This has always been a very elite preoccupation. It's democratizing culture and it's making people feel part of a community, which is in itself integral to the social policy elements of the Venezuelan government and the idea of the Misiones themselves, recreating your society, an inclusivist society.
You also imagine that it might last long after Hugo Chavez is gone and maybe even forgotten.
Well, I'd be very surprised if Hugo Chavez is going to be forgotten for a long, long time. I think that what has happened in Venezuela, and this is the enormous significance of Venezuela in which the United States government fundamentally underestimated, is that Hugo Chavez created a narrative about poverty. Hugo Chavez created a discourse about the relationship between the North and South America. And those issues are huge and pertinent in South America. Chavez has created this whole new regional narrative, which simply cannot be displaced. These changes are permanent. They are, to my mind, a great leap forward in this region. And the challenge ahead is how you now build consensus around poverty and your relationship between the North and the South. That's going to be the key challenge. But these issues are on the table now, and they're part of the mainstream discourse.
Judy Buxton, a word too, please, on Evo Morales, who adds the indigenous dimension and extends the story. But how?
Well, I think the importance of somebody like Evo Morales is that he demonstrates, firstly, that this isn't just something that's Venezuela-specific, these political changes, these demands for an alternative development model. It's not just in Venezuela. It's across Latin America, and it takes different forms. In the Bolivian case, it's taken the form of this indigenous revolution, an indigenous-led process of democratization. So the value of Morales is, firstly, articulating an agenda of indigenous change in a country which is very, very different from Venezuela, but which for years and years and years has retained this kind of colonialist state mentality. So Morales is important because of symbolically what he represents. He's also important because of the political and economic agenda of the Morales government, of empowerment, of engaging with the indigenous development agenda, and of Bolivia's role in the wider South American region. And I think Morales is also very, very important because he raises the issue of coca, okay, as a former kind of coca leader. Now, I think this is going to be a real problem for the United States, because what Morales is saying quite forcefully is that coca is an indigenous product, it's a medicine, it's central to the indigenous culture. Cocaine is a US problem. It's a social problem in the United States. But trying to eradicate coca at source is not working. It imposes fundamental costs on countries like Bolivia and Peru and Colombia, and it is not transforming the fundamental problem you have in the US, which is a social problem of drug use. What Morales is saying is change the dynamics of your war on drugs. Don't have a war on drugs. Have engagement with the issue of drugs. Don't be source-focused. Be demand-focused and respect cultural traditions. It's the US market which is responsible for transforming the dynamics of coca. Let's have a proper, meaningful debate about the drugs war, about the drugs trade, and about the role of coca in indigenous societies. And I think it's taken somebody like Morales to transform that drug debate. And I hope that there is going to be more traction leading from Morales, where we have a meaningful engagement with impacts on the war on drugs and the meaning of that drug war in producer countries.
Doesn't that duck the obvious point that it's the American insane demand for cocaine that sets the price of his hugely valuable commodity? In other words, the value of growing coca would be quite different if the United States kicked its habit.
Well, the value of growing coca for indigenous societies is something which is absolutely separated out from the demand in the United States. You have the production of coca in indigenous societies because it's part of the kind of the health system, the cultural system, the symbolism, the way that indigenous societies relate to the Mother Earth, to the Pachamama. The only value of the drugs, of the coca as it proceeds to cocaine, the end value is only really realised in the United States at the retail end of the commodity chain. So yes, you have people engaged in coca production in Bolivia because they want to be part of that drugs market, not usually through choice, but because of economic necessity, through livelihoods, through survival, as it is with opium in Afghanistan. But the value of coca and cocaine comes from the fact that they're illegal. Once you start addressing the dynamics of the prohibition model, then you strip out the profit, which is based on the fact that this is an illicit commodity. You take away the value added, which comes from the fact it's illegal. And I think what Morales has done is tried to focus our mind back on the fact that if you just accept that this is a product of nature, which is integral to culture, you can have a more meaningful debate around the prohibition system.
Julie Buxton, thank you. You have churned up this conference, and it's a great privilege to hear you again on Open Source.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.